From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the United States remains on high alert over the coronavirus pandemic, isolated cases of the bubonic plague have prompted many to ask, how much worse can 2020 get? Although scientists are assuring a jittery population that the plague is not of concern and has been controlled for many decades, there was a time, well over 100 years ago, when fears over the spread of the so-called Black Death consumed the United States. Writing about how the bubonic plague broke out in San Francisco in the March of 1900 and the race to stop its spread is senior reporter at Reuters, David K. Randall. His New York Times best-selling book is called Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. Welcome to the program, David.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So actually, as per your book, the first case showed up in 1900 in Honolulu, Hawaii, which was at that time not officially a state, and then made its way to California. Tell me about that first case. Ironically, I suppose the disease was also linked to China, as the coronavirus has been linked as well.
So the first known case of the bubonic plague in the United States was found in March of 1900 in San Francisco's Chinatown. And at the time, Chinatown was kind of the epitome of all these different issues that were happening in the country overall. There was rampant anti-immigrant sentiment. Most of that was directed towards Chinese and Japanese Americans. And there was also this issue where modern medicine, as we now think of it, was really coming into its forefront. This was really the era where medicine transformed from somebody, you know, a doctor being very quick with a knife to, you know, microscopes and lab coats and all these other things that we now kind of think of as modern medicine. So the fight against plague at that time was really a fight for the legitimacy of science. And it was a time when, you know, the beginning of modern medicine had to fight one of the scariest and most ancient human diseases.
Tell us about the bubonic plague. I mean, we at first glance, you sort of think about the bubonic plague as this medieval disease, but of course it made its appearance and ravaged many communities, even, you know, in the 1800s and 1900s.
Exactly. So it's the same bubonic plague that you learn about in middle school that devastated Europe in the 1300s, 1400s. It never really went away. It continued to spread. It was in China, and it became a new pandemic in the late 1800s. It spread from southwestern China to Hong Kong, and then India, and then the rest of the world. This was the beginning of, you know, the steamship era and globalization, where disease could travel around the world relatively quickly. 10 million people died in China, 5 million people died in India, and then it's continued to spread. Once it reached Honolulu, it was only a matter of time before it reached the U.S. for the first time.
And it's a horrific disease. It's a zoonotic disease. It's a disease that we now know is transmitted by from animals to humans, but then, of course, becomes rapidly contagious among humans and essentially get, you know, you internally bleed to death. There's gangrene and rot involved. It's pretty horrific, right?
It is one of the scariest diseases, you know, for a reason. At the time, they really knew very little about it. They didn't know how it spread. There was this idea that it was somehow connected to filth. So the biggest thing when there was an outbreak of plague, people tried to sanitize an area as much as they could. They didn't realize that it was really the fleas on a rat, which was the true vector, which would spread the disease. Now, of course, we have antibiotics. If you do have the plague, you have about, and back then too, you have about 48 to 72 hours from the time you catch the plague to essentially when most people die. Now, if you get antibiotics within that time, you're fine and you don't have to worry about it. But back then, it really was a disease that it traveled very quickly. There was no way to know where it was spreading, and there was no known cure for it.
So you mentioned that the time that it entered San Francisco 120 years ago was also the same time when there was this medical revolution. And so the fight against the bubonic plague became, a way for science and medicine of the modern variety to gain legitimacy. And it's so interesting because today, unfortunately, we're 120 years later still struggling with far too many skeptics of modern medicine. But tell me about the doctor at the heart of your story, Dr. Joseph Kinyoon, I think is his name pronounced, and how he is part of this story.
So he was at the time known as one of the most brilliant doctors in the country. He was sent out to, he was part of the US Public Health Service, which was back then called the Marine Health Service. He had a falling out with the Surgeon General and he was sent to San Francisco almost as punishment. So he was there almost in spite of the plague, not because of it. But he was also one of those people that, he was a brilliant person, but he had he lacked the ability to convey that intelligence to someone else. He was one of those people who, almost seemed to make enemies with people on purpose because he could never acknowledge that he could ever be wrong. He couldn't translate all the breakthroughs and, the push forward in science. He couldn't make the average person believe in it. So that was, his undoing in many ways. And when you kind of compare it now, it's an interesting experience to see how, the COVID pandemic. And you start to see these modern parallels. One thing I think a lesson from this book is that you kind of have to have, if Kenyon was the hard part of science, pushing things forward, getting these new disease, these new treatments for disease, that is important. But you also need to have the soft side of science, which is getting people to believe in you and to trust that what you're doing is going to help not only them, but help others as well. And I think that's where you start to see, parallels to COVID-19. That's where a lot of things are falling apart, and the federal response in the U.S. is that it's how we're failing at getting people to acknowledge what they can do to combat a disease that is going to be in the community whether they want it to be or not.
So collective trust in public institutions and in scientific research and health officials, that becomes this critical but often studied aspect of how we bring pandemics under control, right?
Exactly. So there are really two main characters in the book. Joseph Kinyoon, he was right in many ways. Everyone was telling him in San Francisco at the time, they were denying that plague was there and that it was spreading. And he knew that it was basically up to him to prevent the disease from spreading across the country and then killing millions. He had the weight of the entire country on his shoulders, essentially.
Because this was a disease that was in San Francisco, it was spreading fast, and were to leave the city, it could have started off a massive outbreak across the country.
Exactly. And everyone in San Francisco was denying it, going up to the governor of the state. There were people in state in Sacramento saying that Kinyoon should be hung for what he was trying to do. So eventually he gets, essentially run out of town. He briefly tried to quarantine the entire state of California. After that, as a national crisis, Kenyon leaves. Then they bring in somebody else whose name was Dr. Rupert Blue. And whereas Kenyon was really the hard side of science, Blue was the soft side. Kenyon was thought of as genius. Blue barely graduated medical school. No one really thought of him as pushing science forward. But what he had was just a natural affability. He had a way to make people feel at ease and to gain their trust. And he would do things that were considered radical at the time. He would go into Chinatown itself and try to, talk with the community members who were the most impacted. He hired translators so that he could speak with people directly, and he paid the translators the same as he would pay, his white counterparts. Doing these things, which now we think of as common sense, but at the time seemed incredibly, forward thinking. He also focused on things like hygiene, street sweeping, and sanitation. All these things that kind of make a modern city livable in many ways we can attribute to Rupert Blue. But what he did more than anything was that he kind of built up social capital. He found a way to get people to trust him and like him and believe in what he was saying. And it was because of him that, plague was really contained in many ways. And I think that's where we're lacking when we look at COVID-19 and the pandemic. It seems like other countries have done a much better job of building up, focusing on kind of those soft people skills of, you know, of pandemic and public health in ways that, you know, if we look back at our own history and the U.S. history, we can see, you know, we've faced a much scarier disease in many ways than COVID-19, and this is what saved us before.
One might look today at figures like Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand or Angela Merkel of Germany, countries where the disease, where coronavirus is under much better control, where public trust in these leaders was high because those leaders showed, well, leadership. I want to go back to the story of San Francisco and specifically about how the Chinese immigrant population, the East Asian immigrant population in general, what the impact on them was. You mentioned that the plague broke out at a time when there was already anti-immigrant sentiment. Again, many parallels to today.
Exactly. It seemed to, in many ways, confirm everyone's worst fears. That, you know, you had this stereotype of, you know, Chinese, Japanese immigrants as being, you know, people who were not worthy in some way of being in the U.S. That they, you know, they carry disease. That they were these other, you know, these other people who were coming in and taking jobs and bringing disease with them and everything else. And then you really did have a disease break out in this community. So, you know, it really put Chinese and Japanese immigrants and kind of situation, you know, a rock and a hard place. You couldn't ask for assistance from public health officials because they didn't want you there in the first place. But at the same time, you needed this assistance to help prevent this disease. And it didn't help that Kenyon, you know, for all of his brilliance, was incredibly aggressive and draconian in many ways. He tried to go through Chinatown and do a forced inoculation program. And there was no cure for plague. There was just this experimental vaccine that was shown to prevent your chance of getting it by about 50%. But at the same time, it had, you know, pretty significant side effects. So, you know, at the time, the end situation was that, you know, Chinese immigrants started hiding their dead, trying to prevent any, you know, public health officials from knowing how far and how fast the disease was spreading.
What were the measures that were put into place in order to mitigate the disease when there was still not a clear understanding of the disease's origins and how it is spreading? Again, many parallels to today. You know, I understand were efforts to clean the streets of San Francisco, you know, in such a serious way that they were clean enough to eat off of. You know, and doing all of this with a blind sense of, you know, whether or not this was going to have any actual results. It takes a lot of time, coordination, effort, and resources, but you don't know if those mitigation efforts are the right ones.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So at first it was treated as a disease of filth. So that was why there was this focus on just literally cleaning up as much as you could, you know, tearing down buildings or making sure that, you know, having only a certain number of people living within one room or one apartment or one building itself. When that didn't seem to work, that's when Blue came in. And he's, you know, for one of his talents, he wasn't necessarily somebody who was going to, you know, create this new serum or new vaccine or new medicine, but he was willing to think outside of the box and he was willing to try new things. And he was the first one who decided, hey, let's track the rats. And he did things that, you know, were pretty innovative for his time. He, you know, took a bunch of rats and essentially dyed them different colors. You know, this one's fur was red, this one was green, and he released them in the sewers. And then he put a flyer saying, if you've seen a red rat or a red rat or a green rat, please let us know. So he could essentially track the migration patterns of rodents through the sewer system.
And it amazing.
You know, and exactly. And he's the one who first realized that once the disease started spreading through outside of Chinatown and outside of these racial barriers, he was willing to, you know, take away the racial lens of looking at a disease. Mm-hmm. And that was a big step that many people in the medical community could not do. So, you know, he was the one who started to trace that, you know, people going through Chinatown on their way to what was then called the Latin Quarter, which is now North Beach, that's perhaps they were picking up wood or they're picking up other things that fleas or rats had been on, and that was more likely to be the vector of the disease than something that was inherent to, you know, an Asian community or someone who was an immigrant.
Did Rupert Blue's work end up increasing the legitimacy of medicine and scientific research ultimately?
Yes, it did. In many ways, you know, what he did was he was able to bring the city together and say, this is what we need to do collectively to move forward to save ourselves. And he also had, you know, the kind of the carrot and the stick idea. There was going to be the Great White Fleet, which was a big armada of ships, were going around the world, U.S. ships. And it was, you know, for them to land in San Francisco was a big deal. It was going to be a big economic impact in, you know, a positive way. And he was able to go through the city and he would talk to any group who would have them, saying, you know, I can't in good conscience say that the Great White Fleet can land in San Francisco if I don't feel like we have contained plague enough. So he was able to get people to act in their own self-interest. And, you know, he was able to do things like, you know, pay people 25 cents for every rat they brought in. So the city just went on essentially a massive rat killing spree. They brought in, they processed something like 6 million rats, which was, you know, 5 or 6 times the city's human population. And through that way, he was able, you know, they dissected each rat to look for signs of the plague. And that's how they were able to get some data. And, you know, then he had a big map in his office where he would track where each rat was found that had plague or did not. So he was able to show people that, you know, there's data, there's science, there's a public health infrastructure through all of this. And it's not just we're not individuals, we are together, we are, you know, collective, and we work in, you know, city is a living, breathing thing and organism in its own ways, in many ways. So people were able to trust that, you know, science is not a fraud, medicine is not a fraud. This is a new era and we are starting to push forward.
It's so amazing that today in 2020, we have a president who supports the ideas of a person calling themselves a doctor who, as I'm sure you've already heard, believes that certain conditions can be caused by intercourse with demons. So how many people did the plague eventually claim? How many lives did the plague claim in San Francisco? You know, as of the time that you and I are currently speaking, well over 150,000 Americans have died of the coronavirus. But because of the work of people like Dr. Rupert Blue, the deaths from the bubonic plague never even came close to that.
Exactly. It was surprisingly well contained. The issue of a death toll is a difficult one, though, in many ways, because you know, bodies were hidden, and it were, you know, either hidden or, you know, someone rode out, would take a boat into the bay and dump the body as well. So they knew of at least 2,500 people who died. The actual death count is probably many times higher. One of the reasons that Blue and Kenyon before him had so much pushback was that the death toll wasn't higher. People kept on saying, you're telling us this, the plague is here and we're in the middle of an outbreak. Why aren't people dying in the streets? And later, Blue realized the reason for that was that the flea, which really spreads the disease, you know, bites the rats, then bites a human. The predominant flea species in San Francisco has a slight anatomical difference than the predominant flea species in Hong Kong. And because of that, when they bite something, this doesn't inject as much of the plague bacilli into somebody's body. So they get essentially a lower dose of the virus, of the bacteria, so it doesn't cause the same, it doesn't spread as quickly and as easily. So if it wasn't for this small quirk in, you know, the insect population, then there would have been a much higher death count in San Francisco. And I think that, you know, one of those things where...
That's just luck, though, right?
Oh, it was just luck, yes. It was just definite luck. It was had nothing to do with how well they were preventing the disease or not. They essentially got incredibly lucky, and millions of Americans got incredibly lucky that they didn't die from this. And I think one of the things that you see now with COVID is that it's hard for people to accept that how it's a really it's true and that they're in real danger until they start seeing many people die. And it's that's I think one of the hardest things for science to get through now is that you can be in danger, and just because there isn't a death count of, you know, 10,000 or 100,000 does not mean that you can ignore it. And I think, you know, look at COVID now, I don't think, you know, 6 months ago anyone would have thought 125,000 people in the US would have died from this, and it's continuing. You know, it's very likely it'll be 150,000 or more.
And I'm wondering if you saw the same sorts of, or in your research, you found the same sorts of psychological resistance to taking precautions in San Francisco as you see nationwide today. And human psychology can be so confounding and exasperating because, as you were saying earlier, when people don't see huge numbers of deaths, they resist the mitigation effort, saying, well, why do we have to go through this? But then when people start dying, they're upset at elected officials for not pushing mitigation efforts hard enough, right? You're sort of, as a leader, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, unless you're really adept at getting your message across. So was there that same sort of psychological pushback to, you know, to try to curb the disease from spreading in San Francisco in 1900?
Yes, there were many parallels. And it was even farther along, denial was very strong. Mm-hmm. The city papers eventually refused to report it. They,
wow.
You know, now we're lucky that news, you know, we have media that reports, you know, truthfully and accurately how the disease is spreading. Back then, the papers in San Francisco, which were the dominant form of media, essentially came to a pact that said, you know, we don't want this to wreck our city. We don't want it to wreck our economy. You know, California had only been a state for 50 years or so. You know, there are still literal gold miners who are walking around the streets of San Francisco. And California was so many ways was thought of as, you know, this golden place where you can come and live your dreams, and there's no, you're not going to have the same problems you would if you live on the East Coast. And then if you suddenly enter, you know, put plague, an outbreak of plague into that, it undermines the whole idea. And people are very scared. You know, states such as Texas and Arizona and Louisiana, when they heard rumors that there were the plague, started putting signs up saying, you know, we proudly don't sell any California fruits or vegetables. And this was a big, existential shock for Californians. And San Francisco responded by saying, we're just going to deny it as much as possible. So you had this strange situation where people in San Francisco itself maybe knew nothing about the plague. They had no idea there was a plague outbreak, where somebody else who was reading news that were carried by wire services in places like St. Louis or Cleveland or Chicago would know more about the outbreak and spread of the disease than someone, you know, much closer to danger.
And ultimately, I understand the official death toll from the bubonic plague was about 75, but again, probably a huge underestimate. So finally, your book is obviously very timely. I understand that you obviously wrote it before the coronavirus pandemic. Now it's gaining so much more relevance. And I'm wondering whether you, looking back on this history, can see the ways in which the tide might be turning. I mean, right now, for example, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who might be the Rupert Blue of his time, has a much higher approval rating than Donald Trump. There is a greater appetite for mandatory mask laws from a federal level, even. Even among Republicans, a majority of Republicans now support a federal mask mandate. Do you think the tide is turning?
I definitely do. I think that, you know, what the plague experience shows is that you kind of have to go through these stages of denial and everything else to move forward. And public health built on whatever came before it. And, you know, a lot of the things that Rupert Blue revolutionized during the plague outbreak, we now take for granted. You know, we take for granted things like cement sidewalks, which essentially prevent rats from burrowing underneath them. We take for granted street sweeping. We take for granted many, you know, public sanitation measures, which make most communities, you know, livable places where diseases don't spread as easily. You know, we don't have issues like cholera or things like that anymore, because we live, you know, clean water, we have clean streets. I do think, though, you need to have, you know, some kind of face to it, some kind of face to the public health outbreak, which makes somebody, you know, the average person say, you know, I trust this person, I believe in it, I know that they have my best interests at heart, and because I'm looking out for myself, I can therefore take actions that are going to help everybody. Whether that is going to continue, I think what, you know, ultimately makes people believe in public health is a high death toll, which is sad to say, but it's true in many ways. It's, you know, I think the tide is turning on face masks and at a federal level because the disease is spreading. You're going to see higher death counts in Florida and Texas and Arizona. And it's no longer just, you know, 6 months ago or 3 months ago, it was thought it was a New York, New Jersey problem, and now it's a national problem.
Well, I want to thank you so much, David, for joining us today and sharing your insights based on this history that you've written. Thanks so much. Good luck to you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been David K. Randall, senior reporter at Reuters, and we've been discussing his New York Times bestseller, Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.